This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Our guest Matthew McConaughey has played likable characters in a series of mainstream romantic comedies. But he's also made his mark in more dramatic and sometimes menacing roles. In Killer Joe, as a sinister and perverted police detective and hitman. In Bernie, as a vain small-town DA. In Magic Mike, as the owner and MC of a male review in a strip club. In The Paperboy, as a reporter with a secret life, and in Mud, out on DVD next week, as a mysterious loner. McConaughey won Best Supporting Actor Awards from the New York Film Critics Circle and the National Society of Film Critics for Bernie and for Magic Mike. In Mud, McConaughey stars as a man named Mud, living alone on a small deserted island in the Mississippi River. His clothes are torn, his hair is filthy and disheveled, and he's very low on food when he's discovered by two boys on a little boat. One boy is intrigued by the mystery surrounding Mud and the romantic story he weaves about the love of his life. The other is more suspicious. Both boys' instincts are right. This is an early meeting between the boys and Mud.
Now, I like you two boys. You remind me of me. Seeing as how you two is from Arkansas and we know some of the same people, and we grew up in some of the same places, I reckon we can make a deal for something.
A deal for what?
Food. Food for a boat.
He's a bum, Ellis. Come on. Why don't you go get your own food?
Well, I would if I could. See, I told somebody I'd meet him here, so... Well, I'm stuck for now, and what I got's running low.
He's a bum, Ellis. Come on.
I ain't no bum. I got money, boy. You can call me a hobo because a hobo will work for his living. You can call me homeless because, well, that's true for now. But you call me a bum again, I'm going to teach you something about respect your daddy never did.
Matthew McConaughey, welcome to Fresh Air. So I read that Jeff Nichols, who wrote and directed Mud, wrote the part for you. Did he tell you why he had you in mind?
I actually just recently we started talking about it, and he said a few things. He said there's an inherent likability that I see in you and saw in you that is somewhat synonymous with the same reasons you kind of liked Paul Newman and when he was a bastard in movies like HUD. He also said he thought I had sort of a personal politics, that I've kind of got my own philosophies about life and how to go about life and approach it. And he said, you got to be somebody that wanted Mud to be somebody that I wanted to hang out on an island with for 3 months, actually making the movie. And also, if I was a 14-year-old kid having this summer, if I found somebody on an island, who would be the guy that you'd want to say, yeah, I want to spend a summer on an island with this guy?
Even though he looks kind of dangerous, and it turns out he's a killer.
Yes.
So,
yeah.
So you said, the part was written for you partially because you have, like, your own philosophy. The character in Mud, the loner on this island, he believes in spirits, that there are fierce mm-hmm. powers at work in the world, mm-hmm. powers of good and powers of evil. Do you know anybody like him? I've never in my life met anybody like Mud. I'm from cities in the north, not a small town on the Mississippi River. You grew up in Texas. Did you know anybody who remotely compares to this character that you play in Mud?
There have been characters I've met, and most of them probably being in the rural South, that had little bits of knowledge like Mud. But nobody is fully committed and with a full constitution like Mud. I mean, Mud is if he ever came to the so-called mainland and got off of the proverbial island and was sort of reined in by civilization, I don't think he'd survive. So he's really getting his knowledge from the stars, from the river, from Mother Nature. And that's one of the great things about the South. That's where you're gaining your knowledge of how the world works, because you're just engrossed in the middle of Mother Nature, which, I mean, you could say, I think Jeff had said, we'd said Mud grew up, in the woods, surviving in the woods since he was, born, never had a mom and dad really. So I've met people with just taste of Mud, but nobody is living off the grid like he is now.
So I just want to explain, you're at a studio in New York and I'm at a studio in Philadelphia, so we're not in the same room. And when my engineer turned on your mic, you couldn't hear me yet, but I could hear you. And what you were doing was kind of singing, chanting. Part of it was like a meow, 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 meow.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then you were doing this other thing. What was that about?
Oh, it was a couple things. I was kind of banging on my belly and chest and then humming in and then and it's something I do kind of want to get the voice going, which is good for radio and these wonderful mics you guys have.
Yeah, so so that's
also rhythmically it loosens me up. It relaxes me. And you know, third is you always what you used to have. I don't know if you have it anymore. There was a musician, Ali Farka Touré. And he used to be the Segway, or maybe he still is in places. It's from a song, I Do, a great song off of Talking Timbuktu that he worked on with Ry Cooder. And I actually went and met that man, and he's the reason I went to Africa. I found him in a little town called Niafunke on the Niger River, and he has since passed away, I think, a few years back. But that was always that's where a bit of that chest-beating humming comes from, and it's a little call-out to Ali as well.
Huh. So do you do that on the set to warm up your voice and kind of get in the rhythmic
it's a
spirit
rhythm
of
thing.
Yeah.
It's a rhythm thing. It sort of, you know, it takes the periods and turns them into commas for me. So it's I'm music and sound is very important to me. And it relaxes me, and it's sort of it also there's also something relaxing about someone going, "What in the hell is he doing?" You know. And then I'm like, "Good, I got one on you. You're not sure what I'm doing. Okay, we're free." But it's very good for the instrument. It's very good for the acting instrument, too.
So can you do it one more time?
So
that's your chest you're playing. It sounds like you could work McConaughey into that chant.
Yeah, you work. It's got the right amount of syllables.
Yeah, yeah. So you were at the Independent Spirit Awards this year, and one of the films you were there for was Magic Mike. You were nominated for a Best Supporting Actor for that. You won Best Supporting Actor from the New York Film Critics Circle Award. So I just want to play a short clip from the film. Magic Mike, in that film, you own a male strip club with the men's strip in Tampa, Florida. And so as the MC, you also do some stripping and dancing yourself, which is pretty wild. So in this scene, you're advising one of the young muscular dancers how to take off his clothes. Like, you don't just take them off. You're trying to show him how it's really done and what state of mind he needs to get into. And so the young dancer is played by Alex Pettifer.
See, baby, you're not just stripping. Now, you are fulfilling every woman's wildest fantasies. All right? You are the husband that they never had. You are that dreamboat guy that never came along. You are the one-night stand, that free fling of a that they get to have tonight with you on stage and still go home to their hubby and not get in trouble because you, baby, you made it legal. You are the liberation. Own it. Who's got the you do? They don't.
That's Matthew McConaughey in a scene from Magic Mike. So,
what knowledge?
Had you ever been to one of these strip clubs where the men strip for the women?
I went one time just with Channing when he came to New Orleans, Louisiana.
With Channing Tatum.
Just to go see what it was like.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Once I was on board and we were going to go make the film, I said, well, I've never been to any kind of male review, obviously. And we looked up what the hottest review in town was, and the hottest male review in New Orleans that night was basically about 15 miles outside of town in a little strip mall between a laundromat and a Mexican food cantina.
So did you, like, disguise yourselves to go in, or were you recognized?
We were recognized, but I think the interesting thing is we went in a little bit early, And there's three men at the bar. Looked like very conservative men, obviously. I figured they were there for their own delights or whatever, but definitely didn't think they were going to be the guys that ended up on stage, which they were. It was a lawyer. One guy was on the phone talking to his wife and three kids saying goodnight. Another guy had just come back from overseas in Afghanistan, and this was a little sport that he had, a little job that I don't know if anybody knew about that he had. And they were just very sort of conservative guys sitting there drinking water. One had a beer, but that was it. And next thing you know, they're out on the stage. And it was very carny, much more carny. But the women came in. And that was one of the things that I did see when we snuck in the back and watched. There was a birthday party there. There was a bachelorette party. You could see that the women that were in there had this night circled on their calendar for, I don't know, a month. And they were going to go let loose. And no matter how, it was the fun of it, of them sort of busting each other's chops, getting embarrassed, acting more embarrassed than maybe they even were. But they just had a ball. And you know, an hour of it was enough for me, but that was it.
It's funny, you know, I have not been to one of those clubs, but anytime I see it in a movie, like the women are always laughing, you know, as the men strip. Yeah. Which is not the reaction you get in a male strip club, which I also haven't been to. You know, when the women are stripping, I mean, I think the men are just like deeply into it. They're not going, oh, ha, 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 that's so funny.
Well, it is a different type of voyeurism for sure. That's true. Because the men in a female strip club, there's, I think, some more, I don't know, maybe literal fantasy going on. But mm-hmm. You're right in a male review, the women, it is a lot of laughter. I mean, no one's really got a serious look on their face like they're really thinking like, oh yeah, you and me. It's a lot of whoops and hollers and screaming and covering your mouth, and he did not. Oh my gosh. And it's a much more festive gathering. Yeah.
Well, you are so into it in this film in your dancing. So did you have a choreographer teach you how to, you know, do a grinding kind of dance and all the other stuff that you do?
Yes. For me, it was obviously a very intimidating idea. I'm going to go on stage and strip. Okay. And then I was like, well, what am I going to do? First thing I've got to do, what kind of style? And then I thought, well, everyone does hip hop. Is that what I need to do? And then I saw Channing dance and I said, I'm definitely not touching hip hop. He's got that. I'd be a far distant second if I did my best. And so I said, I got to find a song. I got to find who's what's this guy Dallas's music? What's his dance? And then I was jogging. I was in New Orleans, actually, and Calling Dr. Love by Kiss came on my and I was like, that's my tune.
Why is that your tune?
Well, it was just something, it had enough lethargy, it had enough panther, it had enough predatory thing to it. That was the fun of it for him, being the elder statesman, being the guy that, you know, doesn't really do it anymore, but if he does come out and dance, he's going to lay it down old school. and so I did a lot of work with those choreographers of, you know, I think you just play to your strengths. I didn't, you know, I think did my hips get looser now than they were before? Sure. But I just found a few moves that I was like felt more comfortable with, and then we worked around those. And trust me, if I could be choreographing and working on those, that dance to this day, and we didn't shoot that film till next year, I still couldn't have enough time to get ready for that.
You've gone from, you know, romantic comedies to doing some pretty dark, sinister stuff. Case in point, the movie Killer Joe. And In this film, you play a police detective and hitman in a small southern town, and you're very kinky in this, and the kinky parts are too kinky for us to play scenes of, so we'll just stick with sinister. Though I will say, you know, you have your eye on a young girl who's, what, 12, 13 in this?
Dottie, it's a little ambiguous in the film.
She's way too young for you to have your eye on.
Yeah,
you've got your eye heavy on her.
Sure.
But anyway, so here's a scene in which Emil Hirsch plays a gambler in debt who wants to hire you to kill his mother so he can collect insurance money. She's divorced from his father. So he also convinces his father to go in with him on the hit on his mother. And his father will get some of the insurance money, too. Your collateral in this is going to be this young girl who is the daughter who you've got your eye on. So here's a scene with Emil Hirsch as the guy who wants to hire you to kill his mother, Thomas Hayden Church as his father, and also here's my guest, Matthew McConaughey, is the police detective and hitman.
All right. Well, sir, instead of me kicking this off, maybe this, you could tell us the questions we need to ask.
It's pretty simple. You're going to pay me for a service that I'm going to perform. You're going to give me the particulars of her schedule, her habits. I'll act on them accordingly. I won't give you many details on my activities because the less you know, the better for everyone involved.
All right.
Now, I only have a couple of rules that I insist on sticking to. Insist.
Okay, yeah.
If you're caught, if you're implicated in this crime, you are not, under any circumstances, to reveal my identity or participation.
Oh, of course.
If you break this rule, you'll be killed. Do you understand?
I
must be absolutely clear on this point.
I understand.
Do you understand?
Yeah.
My guest, Matthew McConaughey, in a scene from Killer Joe. So I hope you don't mind me trying to describe in as cleansed a way as possible the most talked about scene in this film. Mm-hmm. Gina Gershon plays somebody who has crossed you. I won't say how. And after punching her in the face, you have her simulate oral sex. And this involves a chicken leg that you're holding. I won't say where so as not to get too graphic. Now, actors always say that they try to find the part in themselves that most closely relates to the character that they're playing. And I'm thinking, if you're playing somebody as depraved as this police detective and hitman, if you do have a part in yourself that relates to what he does, you're not even going to want to admit it.
So you might be having some nightmares.
Yeah. So where do you go to play somebody so depraved and sinister?
Probably not as far and deep into the other world that one might, I don't know, initially think. At least for me. I mean, one, there's an underlying just absurd humor to this whole thing. In these situations that on paper are grotesque and sickening. I mean, my first read of the script, I was appalled. I mean, I got upset at my stomach and I was like, I don't want to be anywhere near that. I don't like the world. I don't see what's funny about it at all. I don't like these people. I need to take a shower with a steel brush. And then I talked with a lady I work with who I use and always value her opinion. And she had read the script the same time and got on the phone, and she's howling, laughing, and saying, oh, no, honey, you didn't think that was funny. It's hilarious, da-da-da-da. I was like, okay, I need to set it down for a couple of days, and I'll come back and revisit it. And I did, and all of a sudden something clicked, and I got the music of it, Tracy Letts' writing. So what did I do with Joe? Here's what it was about for me. Order. Joe was about order. If chaos was there, Joe straightened it out. He had different ways of doing this. This chicken leg thing is another way that Joe is creating order. So that was my sort of hinge that I worked off of. And then the other thing was to really not see it as being sinister. See it as totally Machiavellian, like I'm a really bad guy. Joe doesn't think he's a bad guy. Joe, like I said, just wants to create order where there's not. He's very clear about the rules, as that scene that you just played lets him know exactly how this has to go down, if it goes down. And if when the, you know, when what happens and they don't follow the rules, well, okay, you have messed up and now I have to come and by whatever means I do, I create order. So there's a real clarity to his behavior.
You had been famous for romantic comedies for several years. And now you're using your good looks for a different effect. In Mud, your good looks help further the charisma that you have and the kind of romantic story that's at the heart of who you are and what motivates you. In Killer Joe, your good looks kind of add to this character's magnetism and charisma, even though it's a kind of evil charisma. And in Bernie, which is a comedy, your good looks are kind of played down, but everybody, but you're the kind of like heartthrob in the local town. But it's all very comic. So was there a point in your career where you said, "I'm kind of done with the straightforward romantic comedies. I'm looking for something different now." And if so, what was behind the change?
Right. There was a time where I was reading some more romantic comedies. I was reading some more action scripts. And there were quite a few I liked. But there were, most all of them, I felt like I could do them tomorrow. And I think that was where I just said, wait a minute. There's nothing wrong with that. That's great to have something you feel like you could do tomorrow. It's great to have your so-called fastball. And you like doing them. There's a lightness that you are able to keep and maintain in those that they need, because they need a buoyancy. You're not supposed to go deep. You go deep on those, you sink the ship. I had fun doing that and also trying to do those without emasculating the male, which can be done in those romantic comedies often. But I just felt like I could do them tomorrow or the next day. So I said, I want to wait. I don't know what I want to do. I want to wait till something really turns me on, moves my floor. As I said, makes me question it and go, I don't know what I'll do with that material.
So this year at the Independent Spirit Awards, you were on stage twice, once to accept an award for Best Supporting Actor for Magic Mike, and also to introduce the film Bernie, which was nominated for Best Film. And when you're on stage talking about Bernie, you told a story about how the director of the film, Richard Linklater, gave your mother a small role without even telling you. And then she tried to upstage you on the red carpet. And then you told this story.
Continually.
Continually.
Okay. Oh, yes.
And then you told this story.
Since Bernie and her time on screen, she corners every producer that she can find on any set that I'm on or otherwise and pitches her great idea, which is to remake The Graduate with her playing the Anne Bancroft role. And guess who's going to be the Dustin Hoffman role? Me. No. This is my mother. Dead serious. And she might have a good money-making idea, but it is kind of weird. Incestuous and everything. And if you ask her, you go, I've even said it to Mom. I mean, you don't get how that's odd? And her answer is the same every time. He goes, oh, get over it. I've seen it. It's not that big of a deal. These are all true stories.
That's Matthew McConaughey at this year's Independent Spirit Awards. That is a hysterical story. What was your mother's reaction to you telling that story?
Oh, her reaction is that's right, and we still need to make that movie.
Is she serious about thinking that you should play the? I mean, there's two things wildly inappropriate about it. One is that a son shouldn't play a young man having an affair with an older woman when that older woman is his mother. And two, you are both way too old for this role. Like, Dustin Hoffman is like a virgin, probably. He's like a young man.
Yeah. I mean, is she serious? Somewhat. If someone said, I think it's a great idea, let's do it, and came with the financing, she would perk right up and go, yep, I knew it. Is this blasphemous humor? Absolutely. But that's our family. You know, my mother has always wanted to be a solid gold dancer, and she's a heck of a dancer. So she also, you know, has done some plays and some things, and she's been in a couple of little bit parts in films, and she likes it, and she's pretty good at it. And so she ended up getting in Bernie, and anyway, she's always, this goes back 15 years, ever since I got to be successful, and she came out and come to a premiere with me, she hit the carpet and she wanted the camera. She has thrown elbows into my ribs and moved me out of the way of the camera when they're interviewing me on the red carpet. And it actually, I had trouble dealing with it when she first came out because it was all brand new for me. Well, now we completely get the joke. And she's just such a great life spirit that, you know, she's just a yes woman.
There's a picture of her on the red carpet, and I don't know what the ceremony was for. You're not with her. There's somebody who I don't recognize with her. And she's lifting up her skirt to reveal the very bottom of her underwear.
She's probably showing off her hot legs.
Yes, exactly. And I'm thinking,
look at my legs at 81 years old is what she's probably doing.
Did she embarrass you when you were growing up?
No. You get over embarrassment in our family real quickly. And if you do get embarrassed, everyone's going to give you 100% of the dosage. Our family is, no matter how old you are, nothing is precious. You will get, if you have any kind of attitude or you have any sort of hang up where you're not being completely honest, our family will gang up on you and just basically verbally pound you into submission. And as soon as you submit, we all grab you and lift you up and put you on the highest pedestal and then have a party for you. It's a very resilient way that we deal with each other, and it's how we deal with each other growing up. And if anyone had an air about them or anyone was, I remember mom going like, I see you walking on your toes a little bit, getting kind of cocky, huh? Mm-hmm. And then, bam! You were the one that was going to receive the joust from the whole family. It's kind of just how we relate.
Okay, let's try this. In high school, you were voted most handsome.
Yes.
In the school. So, did you have to be knocked down at home after that?
Oh, I think they still. I mean, my brother still jives me about it. I have a wonderful story though.
Yeah.
About that most handsome thing.
Shoot, go ahead. Yep.
Oil of mink was a product. My mother became an in-house salesman for. It was a mink oil that you put on your face. And my mom was turned on to it by my father's secretary. And it was one of these kind of like the Avon ladies. You go door to door and you sell this oil of mink. Well, I'm 15 years old. And my mom's got these tubes of mink oil. And she says, you know, you've got these adolescent pimples and stuff. Maybe you should put the oil of mink on your face and do these masks and stuff at night. And I'm like, that's a great idea, Mom. And we read the label, and one of them says that it pulls out the impurities. And then you'll be clean. You'll never have another blemish in your life. And I'm like, well, this is great, man. If I can get through these, you know, 15-year-old pimply face stuff, it'd be great. So I start putting these oil of mink masks on my face. Well, quickly, my face is beginning to swell up, and I'm forming acne, and a really bad acne. And I talk to my dad's secretary, who turned my mom onto it. She comes over to the house, and I'm really concerned. And the lady's like, wow, well, you just sure have a whole lot of impurities, Matthew. Keep it up. And we'll just pull all the impurities out, because once they're out, you're clean forever. So I stick with it another 3 weeks. It's almost 2 months now, and my whole face, I don't even look like myself. I have full-blown, really bad acne. Go to a dermatologist. He's like, what are you putting on your face? We show him the product. He's like, this is a mink oil base. This is the last thing an adolescent oily-faced kid should be using. This has clogged up your pores. You are about 10 days before you're going to have those ice picks holes in your face from that acne. And we're like, well, geez, how do we help? He got me on medication, ended up being Accutane, which really worked. It was a year and a half, sort of just took the acne away, and we learned our lesson. Anyway, during that time, somebody in the family got the idea of, yeah, you know what, we need to file a lawsuit against Oil of Mink. That's right, our son, Matthew, I mean, you've been, look at you. I mean, you were emotionally pounded and psychologically this really had to hurt. And so everyone started feeling all these, you know, ideas. But yeah, I was emotionally done. Yeah, my confidence was lower. Well, there's a lawsuit filed. I think it's for like $30,000 or something. And as lawsuits go, they take a while. So remember, that was when I was 15. Cut to now I'm 18. senior in high school. I get called in for a deposition by the defense, and he sits me down and he goes through all this, and emotionally this must have been so tough for you, and look at these pictures of this acne you had. Oh my God, I mean, your face is almost bleeding. You look like a monster. This is so bad. Man, it must have really been tough on you. And I'm like, yes, sir, yes, sir, yes, sir. And he goes through this for about 45 minutes. And I'm thinking, this is great, man. This is the defense talking to me, and he's saying all the problems that I had. And then he stops, and he reaches down under the table, and he pulls up this yearbook. And he opens up this page, turns around to me, and slides over, and he goes, what's this picture here, this award you won? I look down at it, and it says, most handsome. And he goes, yeah. It was just really tough, that Olaminka episode, wasn't it? And I shut that book, started laughing. My dad jacked with me and my brothers jacked with me for years after that, going, man, we almost won a $30,000 lawsuit and you got to go in most handsome, you son of a bitch. Man, what are you doing? Trying to make some money in a lawsuit. And what's little brother do? Got to go in most handsome. Thanks a lot, man. You just screwed it up for all of us. So I still get hell about that.
So was being on the stand useful in playing a lawyer, which you've done?
Well, actually, that was in a law office. But I was very interested in law back then. And I thought my path was going to be, I was going to be the family lawyer. I was going to SMU is where I was going to go to school.
Why didn't you become the family lawyer?
I was going to go to SMU. I was going to, because I felt I could get a job in a law firm easier in Dallas than anywhere else that I was going to go to school. And I got a call from my middle brother, and he said, what about University of Texas? And I said, no, I don't want to, I want to go to SMU because it's Dallas, and I think that's where I can get into the workforce sooner and in a law office. And he goes, well, look, Dad's not going to tell you this, but I'm going to tell you this. It's going to cost $16,000 to put you in SMU because it's a private school. But if you go to University of Texas, it's going to cost $6,000. And Dad's not going to tell you, but the oil business is not good right now. And Dad, business is really tough. It would help him out a lot. Because, of course, my dad wouldn't say, I can't afford to send you to SMU. So I called Dad and I said, you know what? I had a change of mind. I want to be a Longhorn. And he goes, God, dog, buddy, I like the sound of that. And I went to University of Texas, and as soon as I got to Austin and what that city was about and how I fit into it and it fit with me, the first 2 years I was still thinking about going to law school, but it's a time when I got really creative and decided, you know what, that's not for me. And that's when I decided to get in the storytelling business, and I didn't think it was going to be acting. I went to film school.
So how did you become an actor then?
In film school, I started when I would be directing something or the photographer or even the AD, I would always find myself jumping on the other side of the camera and acting it out what I meant if I was trying to give direction or saying, well, let me do that. And then when I went to Hollywood, I had a production assistant job that I went out there for. And I was interested in acting, but I still wasn't able to shake hands even with myself that was really going to be a possible career. And somebody liked what I did in Dazed Confused. An agent said, I want to meet you, and sent me out on a read. And the first read I ever had in Hollywood, 2 weeks after I'd been out there, was with a casting director named Hank McCann, and it was for a film called Boys on the Side, which I ended up getting the part and never had to take that production assistant job.
So Dazed and Confused seemed like an aberration to you because did you know the director, Richard Linklater? Were you friends or
no,
something?
No, I didn't. I met the casting director, Don Phillips, on that film in a bar one night, top of the Hyatt, Thursday night, with my girlfriend at the time, Tony Soteros. We went to that bar because I knew the bartender and he'd give me free drinks. And he said, he was in film school with me. He goes, guy at the end of the bar is a producer. He's in town producing a film. I went down to introduce myself. 4 hours later, we're kicked out of the bar. And he says, you ever acted before? I said, man, I was in a Miller Lite commercial for about that long. And he goes, well, you might be right for this role. Come to this address tomorrow morning, 9 o'clock. And at this time, it was already 3 a.m. And I went down there 6 hours later, and there was a script with a handwritten note on top of it. And it had this character's name was Wooderson. There was a few great lines.
Some of them are famous. You want to recite the famous ones?
Oh, well, the one that was like that sent me off, and I was just like, "Who is this guy?" Is when they're out front of the billiards joint, and the ladies are walking by, and Wooderson's checking them out, and he's there with the character played by Sasha Jensen, and Sasha's like, "You better stop that, man. You're gonna end up in jail." And Wooderson's like, "No, man. That's what I like about those high school girls, man. I get older, but they stay the same age." And it's a great, it was like, what, that was the piece for Wooderson that I was like, that's not a line. That's his being. That's his philosophy. He wasn't, there was no attitude to it. This was this guy's DNA, and he had it figured out.
So let's play the actual scene, which we have ready to go. This is Dazed and Confused, which is set in 1976 on the last day of high school. Matthew McConaughey plays somebody who's already out of high school. He's kind of too old for this, but is still hanging with the high school kids.
So you're a freshman, right?
Yeah.
So tell me, man, how's this year's crop of freshman chicks look?
Well, you're gonna end up in jail sometime really soon. I know that. But
no, man. Yeah. No, man, I'll tell you. Yeah. That's what I love about these high school girls, man. I get older, they stay the same age.
Yes, they do.
Yes, they do.
A much younger Matthew McConaughey in a scene from Dazed and Confused, which was directed by Richard Linklater. So I heard that your parents were married and divorced and married and divorced. Was that confusing for you?
I didn't know. Again, those things you find out after after your father passes away. I thought Mom was on some extended vacations. You know, I thought she was down in Florida. And I didn't, you know, but I didn't question why Dad and I moved into a trailer park outside of town, and it was just he and I for the whole summer. I didn't question it. Again, my older brothers probably went through and understood what was happening. It wasn't really confusing. I mean, there were never times where I remember, like, oh, my God, where's Mom? I mean, the summer I had with my dad when Mom was gone, boy, that was neat. I'm going to spend it with Dad. You know, so it was never confusing. I mean, I never questioned, oh, are Mom and Dad split up? Does one love me more or love me less? We didn't have none of that.
What was high school like for you?
I had a very good time in high school. I took care of my business. I made my A's from Mom and Dad. I was socially active. I was mostly very extroverted. I had a good friend, though, who has a lot to do with why I'm doing what I'm doing today, named Rob Bendler. He was the introvert, so to speak. And he was the one who introduced me to, hey, you don't have to go party Friday and Saturday night. I'll go party with you Friday night, but Saturday night, let's go to my place and watch a movie. And so he introduced me to films. He introduced me to art. He introduced me to storytelling. And he was writing scripts. And he went to NYU. And he was the one who said, why don't you go try and act? He was the one, when I couldn't even dream about it, he was saying, no, I think you could do this and do it really well.
What's one of the films that you fell in love with that made you fall in love with movies?
At that time, I think it was like Angel Heart, that Alan Parker film I loved with Mickey Rourke and De Niro and Lisa Bonet. I really loved that film. Hud was always a favorite of mine, the Marty Ritt directed film with Paul Newman. Later on, Indian Runner, Sean Penn's film, wonderful film that Viggo Mortensen and David Morse were in. Raising Arizona was my comedy, you know, the most quotable that I've watched over and over and over. And then again, the only movie I saw before I was like 15 was King Kong. And I must say,
which version, the remake or the original?
The remake, introducing Jessica Lange.
With Jeff Bridges.
Yes. And
it's a terrible film, I think. Really? Okay, you cried.
Oh, I loved it. Really? I absolutely loved it. And I'm very interested in this measurement across the board. It's like I was whatever age I was, 12, 13, 14. And I've never had more enjoyment in a film-going experience than that hour and a half that I was in for that movie at that age. Hmm. I cried because I knew Jessica Lange and King Kong could have made it. I knew that they could have made it. You know?
Well, Matthew McConaughey, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us. It's really been fun. Thank you.
Oh, my pleasure. My pleasure.
Matthew McConaughey speaking with Terry Gross. McConaughey's film Mud is out on DVD next week. Coming up, David Edelstein reviews the new teen romance, The Spectacular Now. This is Fresh Air.